countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
It's another wet one out there where we are. It's dark and dank and damp. So what else, of course, will we be talking about? Sorry to spoil your Saturday morning, but it's the weather. Yes, the weather. We love talking about the weather. We meet each other on the street, and when we pick up the phone to talk to a friend, we begin with a comment about the weather. It's the real Irish hello, how are you? But for farmers, it's more serious than that. And I wanted to find out how things are going around the country, particularly for tillage farmers who, after the harvest, take a little bit of a break at the ploughing championships and then they're back into it again, sowing crops for the winter. But I think they've been finding it difficult. So no better man to give a call to than Andy Doyle, tillage editor with the Irish Farmers Journal, who himself has been around the country and chatting to farmers. Andy, how are you? You're in Kildare this morning, isn't that right?
Yes, indeed, Damien.
What's it like there?
Exactly as you described, not raining, but dull, overcast and not very inviting.
Will you give me a picture of how the wet weather is affecting sowing and planting and our tillage farmers?
I will indeed. I think the very simple way of saying it is that the weather has been relatively unseasonal for the second part of the year. Most places are not yet at their national average rainfall level, so it's not yet a wet year for most. Some are on that point, and some have a good bit more rain to get, depending on where you are in the country. But the problem, I think, that we suffered in the tillage areas on the East Coast is that we had a relatively dry first half of the year, and we all remember the glorious weather for the ploughing, and the problem is that the rainfall levels have caught up since then, and that, of course, has badly affected the whole planting season. Mm. It was difficult for some people for the end of the harvest as well. But planting and the harvesting of potatoes, maize and fodder beet has all been made more difficult by significant levels of rainfall at this time of the year in those tillage areas.
Yeah, because Med Éireann's issued a yellow weather warning in the southeast. It's in action at the moment, I think, until about 3 o'clock today. So that gives you an indication. And it's in those counties, Wexford, Carlow, that sort of country. Some parts of that part of the world have doubled the rainfall for this time of the year. Now, under EU rules, Andy, as far as I know, tillage farmers must plant 2 to 3 different crops under greening and all of that. Now, that must be a real headache. Are they worried they're not going to be able to do that, and they get fined if they don't?
It certainly is a worry. There may be options in the spring. Hopefully we'll get decent spring weather, and there are a number of crops there that could be. But the problem will be that you can't legislate for this in commerce. And the challenge is much more likely to be lack of seed availability to give them that spread than it is to have a lack of willingness to be able to do it. Yeah. And in that regard, I know that our Department of Agriculture are asking questions about the fact that we're caught in this dilemma and looking to see what might be done about it when and if the time comes.
All right. Finally and briefly, Andy, cattle have been housed in some cases earlier this year as well. Like, I wonder, could we be heading for another one of these fodder shortages? Just your colleague, Lorcan Allen, there, he's a farmer as well. He tweeted last night, "It's amazing how nature gives and takes away. We made a record amount of silage this year, thinking we wouldn't need half of it. But the terrible weather has cattle in a month earlier and they're mowing through the pit. We need every bit of it yet." Now, we shouldn't get too excited, but could we be looking at, if things don't change, another fodder problem?
I don't know if we could be looking at a fodder problem, Damien, because as that comment said, you know, there is a lot of fodder there. But, you know, there's an old saying that goes, if God grows it, God eats it. This is not new. We've always had to be conscious of times of bounty, because with them you can be accompanied by times of challenge. You may very well get a cold winter. You could get a mild winter with grass growing, but if it stays wet right the way through to May, it's going to be very difficult. You never know. We have to be prepared for all types of eventualities in this country, regardless of the system of farming that we're using.
The life of the Irish farmer, the predictability, the only predictable thing is the unpredictability of the weather. And people listening to us say, there they go again, farmers whinging. If it's too dry, they're giving out. If it's too wet, it's too wet. But they tend to forget that it's due to farmers trying to produce food for us to actually eat in a safe and traceable and relatively cheap way. Andy, I'll let you go. Thanks for taking the call this morning. We'll chat to you soon again.
You're very welcome, Damien.
All right, good luck there. That's Andy Doyle there in the Farmers Journal. Now, John Keane and Jonathan Dwyer, they're young farmers, both in their 20s, both members of Machrana Ferma in Devil's Bit in County Tipperary. Now, I met them at a conference earlier this year and they were telling me how they noticed the increase in mental health issues among their farming peers and other rural dwellers. So they decided to do something about it by establishing Make the Move, M-O-O-V-E. Now, they've been travelling around the country over the past few months at the invitation of different farming groups and organisations to have that conversation about loneliness, isolation and suicide prevention. Well, this week, Ella McSweeney called into Jonathan Dwyer on his farm in County Laois to find out a little bit more about how they're getting on.
Come on, guys. Come on.
28-year-old Jonathan Dwyer is a dairy farmer from Boris and Ossory in County Laois.
We're milking 320 cows here at the moment and we'll be calving now 540 cows next year.
Farm life is full on for Jonathan, but it hasn't stopped him spending every spare hour he has on something he feels strongly about, farmers' mental health. He set up an initiative to support positive mental health among farmers called Make the Move.
Where we are, where the club is based, is in North Tipperary, which unfortunately has one of the highest rates of suicide among young people in the country. Unfortunately, two older gentlemen then also in the past 2 or 3 weeks also died through suicide as well, you know, and they're both farmers, you know. So, you know, it's there, it's prominent, it's happening. The idea of Make the Move was born out of those kind of things and trying to create something that, you know, really isn't there at the moment, you know.
How are you?
I'm Johnny. How are you?
Good now, yourself?
Not too bad. Busy?
Yeah, kept going now, yeah.
Finished making.
The other person behind Make the Move is 26-year-old John Keane, a beef and dairy farmer who lives nearby.
What are we fixed for tomorrow night?
Sure. Well, I have a presentation done up there anyway.
It's evening, and John has come over to Jonathan's house for a meeting.
I'll give Dermot Murray a shout.
Yeah, because we want to see how many people are going to be there and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Tonight, they're preparing a Make the Move talk for a group of farmers in Roscommon.
Hello.
Dermot, how are you?
Good.
Dermot, how are things?
I mean, what came apparent throughout our consultation, time and time again among older farmers and young farmers as well, it became really clear to us after our first initial public consultation meeting was in January 24th, 2019 in Racket Hall in Roscrea. We had about 90 people came to that meeting. We had two people told their personal stories at the meeting, so their own battles with depression. And it was the openness in the room, and I suppose it was real kindness in the room. The level of responses,
it just completely took us back. You know, we wanted to help people, and they either knew someone that unfortunately died through suicide or suffered from some kind of mental health problems or whatever it is, and they kind of wanted to be probably more aware of it themselves and maybe more aware of their own personal mental health.
What is it, do you think, about farming at the moment that is causing people to feel feelings of depression or driving them to suicide? Or is there something about farming that's doing that?
I suppose the big issue that's there and that is isolation. That's probably number one. And then probably the other big one then is you know, the pressure to expand. So kind of, you know, get bigger, get out, which is then putting people under massive pressure to do these things that maybe they don't want to do. In actual fact, they're quite happy at the level they're at and there's actually nothing wrong with that. But we kind of need to start talking about this and have that kind of an attitude, because it's not all about being as big as you can get. It's being happy at the end of the day.
There is a cohort of farmers that we met during the consultation. One guy in particular, I remember telling me, he said he starts his working week on a Monday, we'll say, and it's Saturday evening before he gets to meet somebody, anybody.
My thoughts got very, very dark the longer I went on up there. For the first time really in my life, suicide became a real contemplation in my life.
Bill Gleeson is a Make the Move volunteer. He's a dairy and beef farmer from Tipperary. In 2014, he spiralled downhill with thoughts of uselessness and hopelessness. One day, he suddenly decided to leave the farm for Dublin, where things took a traumatic turn.
I came back, I'd visited a friend one day, and I came back to the house I was staying in the next night. And somewhere along that line, I couldn't tell you where, I'd made up my mind that I was going to take my own life.
And what happened?
I woke up 12, 14 hours later. I felt so useless that I hadn't even managed to do that right. Thinking about how useless I was, that I hadn't even managed to take my own life. I was very good at hiding what was wrong with me. People would meet me and said, Bill is fine. You know, I was chatty. I was the same person that I suppose anybody that knew me would have ever thought I was. Inside, it was totally different. Inside, my head was, it was described to me as a washing machine. It just never stopped. My mind was constantly spinning. Thoughts constantly going around in circles in my head. Had I done this right? Had I done that right? Where this had gone wrong or that had gone wrong? What was I going to do with my life? Like, that I felt that I was completely useless.
With his family support, Bill got professional help and undertook a 2-year programme to give him the tools to manage his mental health. Last April, for the first time, he stood up in front of 40 farmers at a Make the Move event and told his story.
Nobody really knew my full story. So I had to go outside for 10 minutes and gather myself. I think I was physically shaking. The two guys, they walked out with me, but I was physically shaking walking out the door over having told this to everybody that was in the room that night.
And how did you feel at the end of it?
It felt good. And it only really started to feel really good when it finished and I was just chatting to people. There were 7 or 8 of them people that contacted me to say they had been through similar problems. You wouldn't have picked any of them out of a room. Yeah, I'm delighted that I'd done it. I'm delighted that I could be assistance with Make the Move and be one of their speakers.
And how are you now, Bill?
Good. I can have ups and downs. I can have a rough week where things are a little bit tougher or whatever, but I'm able to deal with them all now.
You know, we really do need support at government level, at policymakers level, to make something happen from this. We're not going to give up until we get something from this. So
talk to me about 5-10 years down the line. Where is Make a Move going? And where...
The Bahamas or Jamaica for 3 weeks.
Oh, it would be grand.
The big one, obviously, would be that we'd have a fully fledged service or a network, if you want to call it that, across the country with a helpline built into that.
So catching it early.
Catching it early, and that seems to be the big thing. If you catch it early, if you're becoming under pressure, that you can have someone to talk to.
If we work with this together, we can definitely make strides into it as a farming and also as a society.
Well done to the two lads there, Jonathan Dwyer and John Keane, with their Make the Move, MOOVE@gmail.com. That's their email address, just if you'd like to help out or get involved to find out more about what they're doing. MakeTheMove@gmail.com. Well done to Bill there as well, sharing his story with Ella. Now, if you've been affected with any of the issues raised in that report, there is loads of help available, including from the likes of the lads there. But your local GP will always give good advice. The Samaritans are always there on 116123. And the IFA and Pieta House Mind Our Farm Families, they have a helpline, 1890 130 22, and we'll tweet those as well. How much food do you consume outside the house? Well, on average, about 1/3 of the money, 33% or thereabouts, of the money that we spend on food every day, or about 8 billion euro, is spent in food services outlets, like, you know, the morning coffee you grab and go, the lunchtime wrap, that delivered Chinese takeaway, pub grub, of course, the restaurant dinner, and so on and so forth. Now, Maureen Gahan is food service specialist with Amborbia, and she's here with these latest statistics and trends about our food consuming habits. Good morning.
Morning, Damien.
How are you, Maureen?
Very well,
good,
thank
to
you.
Welcome you to the show. Now, I mentioned some of the types of food in my introduction there that falls into this category, yeah, of 33 euro and every 100 that we spend is spent on this. But can you describe what food service really is then?
Yeah, well, we describe it as anywhere that food and drink is either bought out of home or prepared out of home. So you reference that home delivery. That's a growing part of it now as well, whether that's your local takeaway or these third party Just
Deliveroo,
Eat, Deliveroo, exactly,
that, yeah,
growing and year on year. But also it could be your petrol forecourt, your spar, if you're picking up a coffee on the way to work, something on the way to school, right throughout the day. And it includes everything like workplace restaurants. It, yeah, includes on board on trains or planes. So
Everything that we're not cooking ourselves in the kitchen.
Correct. And where we're spending money on food that's not in the supermarket.
Well, when you talk about the trends, where are we going? Is this growing? Or
absolutely, yeah. We're
much?
Seeing it's growing. It's been growing year on year for the past number of years. And that's as a result of a number of factors. But I suppose one of the things is that as consumers, more and more are spending longer outside of the home on a daily basis, whether that's longer working hours or longer commutes. So invariably, we're starting to spend more money on food and drink out of home. Also, it very much reflects the economy. And as our economy has been in growth over the last number of years, consumer confidence is up. There's more disposable income out there. Unemployment is at a record low, so more people at work. So all of those factors. And I think habits are changing as well. And we talk a lot about the day-to-day or everyday food service occasions. I think more and more they are part and parcel of people's lives, and they may not even stop to think about the money that they spend on that coffee or whatever it is. And I think all of that combines to support a really strong growth. We're seeing, last year we saw a 4.5% increase, but you know, years previous to that we were looking at 5-6% year on year, which is very healthy.
Yeah, so the day the lunchbox is gone, the man that makes the lunchboxes, well, has gone out of business.
Not necessarily, but maybe, you know, so some people might bring lunch into work a couple of days a week, but on the other days they're eating out.
They're eating out, okay. So everywhere I go now, coffee shops, and all the branded coffee shops and new types of coffee shops and baristas and all of that. That's really a growth part of this food service area, isn't it?
Has been. I suppose it helps that caffeine is a drug. So
in
terms of repeat business, that's always a good place to be. But I guess also, we're more familiar when we've maybe become more educated or perceived to be more educated in terms of our coffee and how we like our coffee. And everybody has a view on that. And you just are seeing them. There's more choice and more availability. Yeah. So if you think like about the Apple Greens and the Circle K's and the Spar shops, a lot of the retailers who would have traditionally had shelves and selling grocery are taking those out and making space for coffee shops and sit down because they recognise that that's where that food to go in particular is where the trend is.
As you said, even in the supermarkets now, that you can get coffee. Well, Suzanne Campbell went out and about to ask people on the street about what they are spending in these coffee shops and in that food service area generally.
Well, coffees, I spend about €3 a day on coffee.
Okay.
So over 10 days, that's €30.
That's quite a lot.
Yes.
And food outside the home, do you spend much on food in restaurants, cafes, takeaways?
When I think about it, like I had lunch with my child today and I spent €15 actually. And that's maybe twice a week. I might spend 15 by two, by three actually when I think about it now.
It's getting bigger all
it is,
the time.
So that's like €500 a month on eating out. Wow. I don't think you think about it because it's a small amount.
You don't.
And it adds up over the days. But if I did the maths on it, like I have just done now, I'd be shocked. I am shocked.
Coffee shops, I mean, addiction, you know. People love their coffee, I suppose.
Would you eat out in the evenings much?
Occasions sometimes, but not all the time. Always at home, home-cooked dinners.
How much do you think you'd spend a month on food outside the home?
Maybe €100, €100.
Would it surprise you that we spend a third of the money we spend on food outside the home?
It would, yeah.
No, it wouldn't surprise me at all. We work in Ace and I think there's roughly about 60 coffee shops alone in Ace. Yeah,
60?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
It's become another social outlet rather than probably going to the pub or stuff like that. People are meeting more for coffee.
What's in that? Is that a coffee?
No, tea.
A tea, where'd you get that?
In Dunn's.
How often a week would you buy out a tea or a coffee?
Probably twice.
Do you ever go out to takeaways?
I don't go out, I order them.
You order them?
Yeah.
How often?
Once every two weeks.
Okay, what about yourself?
Every Sunday I probably have a roast in the West Wicklow or a Chinese.
I often see loads of school kids at garages buying rolls and stuff. That's an expensive habit, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say a roll's about €3, so and like if you get one every day, it's quite a lot of money.
4 years up, you're allowed to like, go uptown, so people like would go to the Chippers or Dunn's or Super Value or something like that and get rolls or drinks and stuff like that. You can get meals for €3, get a roll and a drink and stuff for like €3, but getting that every day is a lot of money.
I suppose when people go out shopping now, it's not just functional as in they're going to shop, it's kind of a social thing as well, so they go and they have the cup of tea as well as doing the shopping. Yeah.
But across the month, you wouldn't spend a third of your household spend on food outside.
No, I wouldn't.
What about you?
No, it'd be only coffee and a scone or coffee and a bun or something.
How often would you dine out?
Once a month.
Yeah, maybe once a month. Once a fortnight, depends if the kids are home or there's family home and you go out for a meal together or something. But normally, no, not that much. I like my own food.
Well done, you obviously cook good food.
She's a good cook.
That's Suzanne Campbell there chatting to people not far from where you are down in Wicklow, down there in Blessington. But you know the way it's such a treat, Maureen, for us to get dressed up and go out on a Friday or Saturday yep. night? Is that lessened now by the fact that we've probably, you know, had our lunch out somewhere as well?
I don't necessarily think so, Damien. I mean, there are still very much, you know, those kind of special treat occasions. And what we're finding actually is now more and more with the rise of things like Netflix and so on, eating out is very often our only form of entertainment. So people are still looking forward to that. They're looking for more kind of entertainment. It's all about kind of maybe more casual, sharing, something that they can share online as well in terms of pictures and Instagram. And what we're seeing then is that at the other end of the scale, you've got the everyday occasions. But I do think that that eating out, the human interaction, that's what we heard from the consumers we spoke to this year as part of our research. Yeah. It's still very important to them.
Now, we are becoming more concerned about the environment and about food waste and about our health. And it would seem to me that, you know, dashboard dining, as we call it, running into the deli or the fast food, that's counterintuitive to all of, you know, that I suppose holier-than-thou attitude that we're all adapting. Is the food service area, is that adapting to our demands to change?
I think it depends. You're absolutely right. We heard from consumers as well that healthier choices and the ability to kind of customise and control when they're eating out of home is ever important. And there are, you know, options for them. There are a growing range of options for them. And the whole sustainability piece in terms of, you know, packaging and how does that link in with grab and grow, we're seeing some of the industry make changes there as well. One of the speakers on our panel at our food service seminar the week before last was from Bread 41, which is a bakery on Pierce Street. Yeah. They've introduced a really kind of a bold initiative on Mondays. So it's Keep Cup Mondays. If you go in there on a Monday, they will not sell you a coffee in a disposable cup. So you either bring your own or you have a coffee on site. So, I mean, I think as the industry starts to change, because consumers are looking for those solutions, it's about providing them to them.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, though, if I was a farmer listening to this, I'd be getting a bit worried that, you know, the food that I prepare and produce to be sold in the supermarket now, that the supermarkets find themselves being squeezed out. If we're eating more and more of our lunch and dinners, you know, in the food service, we're not going to buy as much in the supermarket. So are the supermarkets going to push down the price?
Well, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, the reality is that there's huge opportunities for those farmers in terms of the products that are going into food service as well. And a huge amount of the companies that we work with in terms of primary ingredients, whether that's meat or seafood or vegetables, they're all going on menus as well. And we've companies that are, you know, involved on bakery and yogurts and everything else. So there are opportunities for the food and drink companies. It's whether that's in retail or food service. And I think I mentioned earlier with the supermarkets, a lot of them now are getting into that space as well. So they're going to follow wherever the consumers are driving. And the research that we bring to the market year on year is about trying to stay as close as the consumers as possible so that the food and drink companies we work with can understand what's happening at that end space and can really, you know, make informed decisions on where they're going to try and target.
It's a very detailed paper that you launched earlier this week. Can people go online and have a look at it?
Absolutely. So it's the boardbia.ie website and then /foodservice2019. You'll get a full report. You'll also get copies of the presentations from our seminar. So boardbia.ie/foodservice2019.
All right, we'll tweet that as well because we only scratched the surface.
Absolutely,
there.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about.
There's a lot of colour in it and a lot of telling us it's a mirror to our daily consumption.
And I mean, the good news is that there are opportunities there for the food and drink companies that we work with.
All right, listen, great to chat to you, Maureen.
You too.
Thank you very much for dropping by this morning, and we'll chat to you again in the future. Maureen Gahan there, a food service specialist with Boardbia. Now, we spoke last week about how horses are providing valuable therapy for children with special needs. But of course, horses were once a common feature of Irish life. They ploughed the fields, transported heavy loads and brought families to town and to mass and to the doctor, to football matches. But of course, that day is largely gone. Completely gone in many parts of the country. But for Sibby McCarthy and Patrick O'Driscoll, the passion for horses lives on. If you're passing through Littleton in County Tipperary, you're likely to see them travelling by horsepower on sulkies or road cars. Mary MacDonald joined Sibby and Patrick as they set out for an afternoon on the open road.
When I get up first thing in the morning, I get a cup of tea and I can't wait to get down where the horses is, to spend some time around them. Well, I'm better known as Sibby McCarthy, you know. Everyone knows me as Sibby, which Peter is my proper name, but I'm known as Sibby around the world. Biggest horse fan, I suppose, in Ireland, England, Scotland or Wales, I'm on them. That horse in front of us is my daughter's horse. She calls him Duck.
So Duck at the moment is just kind of
giving himself a shake.
Yeah. He is. He's just shaking yeah. the hair there. Shaking is the he hair, mad right. to get going?
Yeah, lovely. He's a lovely, obedient animal, that fella there now. And he's lovely to jog on it. But he likes his run. He do like his running. He likes his exercise, you know. He's a red and white pony. A lot of people call him a screwball. But he's a red and white pony. That's what the traveller call him. He's 14-2.
I'm pulling up here now onto the cart. There's a padded cushion.
We're going for a nice, peaceful little jog to clear the mind and give us a bit of relaxation. Come up, duck. Everyone on before, no?
I was hardly ever even in a horse and cart before. How would you describe this?
This is a road car. It's a two-seater for a road car, you know.
Yeah.
And you have the sulky, which is only a one-seater. It's brilliant to clear the mind. And I had a problem on my mind now, Mary. And we'll just say you're a close friend of mine. And there's something going on in my life or something going wrong in my life. Well, I can chat to you. There's no one here but me and you and the horse. And it's a private conversation after that. Then we have a nice chat about everything that's going on. And it gets it off and frees the chest and clears the head, you know. Do you know, they're lovely, lovely thing to... Lovely thing to be sitting on and driving. It's so peaceful up in it. And relaxation. And you have a great view of the country. You can even see your man's apple trees growing. Look, his rhubarb, his scallions. You know?
Yeah, we're going at a nice, slow pace past the garden there.
You'd be going past it now, wouldn't you? You wouldn't see that. Even if you had a little pump there, look.
We're down a small little lane here in Littleton.
You're down the Well Road. It's the old name, but Liskeveen, actually. That's Kevin's Park, you just passed behind you. All the travellers used to stay along there years ago. But they put up all the old banks and drains so they can't pull in anymore, you know.
Would you remember that yourself?
I do, then? I actually stood there myself. I did be gone. Remember it quite well. My uncles used to stay there, my father, the bed of heaven, and mother, the Lord of mercy, they're all passed on now, you know.
Would you have had the horses back then?
Horses? Never without a horse. Everyone had horses then. You had all the settled community had horses. You had the Orney man in the cottage had the horses. You had the farmer had the horses. Everyone had horses. Everyone depended on them. So they respected them a lot more. But then when they got into the cars, they have no more respect for a horse on the road. Now some people do, I'm going to be honest with you. Some people give sort of very good respect on the road. You know, they pull up and they give you the right of way. But then you get the hooligan that's on the road don't give that respect also, you know. But mind you get an odd horse driver that does the same thing, you know. Don't give the respect neither. So if you don't give it, you can't get it. It's a two-way system, isn't it, you know. How are we getting on, all right? It's a lovely day. Now some people like that man there, very nice man. You say, well, how are you getting on, nice day, whatever. But then you see the other fella put his head through the ditch and wouldn't speak to you, you know.
How does that feel?
Well, that feels as if you're a piece of vermin, doesn't it, really? You know what I mean? It feels as if you're just something that was dropped out of the sky. We're Irish people, we're born and reared in it, you know. Keep a nose on his ears now. You see the way they're cocked? Now watch him starting to move them, and he'll give the chuck of the head. He wants to get go harder. Watch him.
Just so keep he's moving that head.
Yeah, you see him get pulling the rope. He wants me to release him to go. Go on, duck. You know, if we're doing that now, people are concerned about racing, but it's not racing, you know what I mean? He just loves his run, as you can see. He's just waiting to go all times. Easy, duck. Easy, 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 easy now, boy. Easy. Easy, easy.
So we can see the hair on duck's back just kind of bouncing there
yeah,
in the wind.
Yeah, he just loves it as floating along,
faster.
Yeah. And some people begin to see a horse and he's a fit-looking horse, slimmish. Say, well, geez, he's elected. He's not. He's a healthy horse. It's when you see the horse overweight. He's elected because he gets such thing as called laminitis, you know. Easy, lad. Now he usually pulls in and gives him a little bit of grass for a couple of minutes. He loves his bit of grass, as you can see.
So we've just pulled into a little grassy area on the verge of the road there.
Yeah.
And immediately Duck is having
a
little snack.
Sticking his head down, yeah. This horse here, when I sit up and I meet, everything is on my mind, it clears out, you know. It's just the relaxation of it. And the horse is, he's your medicine, he's your psychiatrist. You know what I mean? There's things you can speak about and not speak about. And when you're on this here, you feel free to speak about whatever you want, you know.
And is that something that you would do, you know, a couple of you go off together for an afternoon?
Seth and the kids and sometimes the grandkids, we go for afternoons on a regular basis on a jog. Summer evenings, we love it, you know. it clears the minds and it keeps the suicide down in the traveller community, you know, because they depend on the horse for everything, the relaxation and the lot, you know.
And that's a really strong thing to say, like, that it would keep down suicide levels.
Oh, yeah, it keeps it down big time. And since the pressure of all this come in with them putting bans on the horses and new regulations on the horses, the suicide has gone up dreadful high in the travelling community, you know. If I come along this road now, it's so relaxing, so peaceful, it clears my mind. And, you know, if I was boxed in an area, if I'm in a boxed in state of houses or town, I don't, you know, I'm not used to that life. I'm used to the country life. And when I get fed up or bored or I feel getting depressed, I'll just harness up this horse and take him for a couple of miles of a run. And it gives me a great relief inside, you know. You just give them a little run because he's asking for it. All right, go on, Duck, then. Go ahead.
And he's flying it.
Go on, Duck.
The wind is flying through our hair and his hair
now.
Yes,
well, it's flying through yours. I ain't got any. You feel free, don't you? You know. You feel free.
And that was Sibby, Peter McCarthy, ending that report by Mary McDonnell of Grey Heron Media. That piece was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Now, Sibby is chairperson of Tipperary Traveller Horse Owners Association. The association promotes positive horse ownership by travellers in Tipperary. And that was in Littleton. And Colm O'Leary, my next guest, that's where your grandfather's from, Littleton.
Yeah, well, actually, Johnstown.
Johnstown,
nearby.
Nearby, yeah. And Littleton, of course, a famous place made famous by Effin Eddie of that famous Tipperary under 21 football match many years ago. Anyway, we're going away off here because Colm O'Leary, my next guest, has completed a round the world trip, which has taken him to farms across Europe, Australia, Africa, New Zealand and the USA as part of a scholarship provided by Nuffield Ireland, which is part of a global organisation that offers scholars the opportunity to conduct novel research and report on subjects with an agricultural theme. And Colm, a young dairy farmer from near Blarney, has just finished the globe trotting. Your study was on animal welfare, particularly cows on farms. Tell us a little bit more about it and how that came about. And good morning officially to you, Colm. You farm in Blarney with your parents, Tim and Catherine. Was your dad that kind of encouraged you to do this?
Good morning, Damien. So I studied agriculture in UCD and I graduated in 2013. And I came home farming full time with my parents. And I suppose the young fella coming home farming, there's always going to be a small bit of conflict about how we do things and me trying to bring in maybe new ways. And I was always interested in doing an off-field scholarship. And I was trying to think of a topic that I'd like to do it on. And 'twas Dad suggested to me, look, you're passionate about the animal welfare. Yeah. Stop giving out to me about it. Give out to everyone about it.
How did you give out to him about it? Or why did he say you're so passionate?
I suppose there was just a number of practices on farm that I was keen to change. So, for instance, I was very eager that we'd use pain relief when we were dehorning calves. I wanted to stop freeze branding the cows because, you know, I didn't think it was worth the bit of a pain that it causes cows for the sake of our convenience. A few things like that and just generally how we handled the cows. And I was very keen to create a low energy environment where livestock would be kept calm and quiet at all times. And it was just, it takes a bit of a change the way you handle livestock because they have to get used to the new system but, you know, ultimately it pays off.
And is this a feature of your generation? Now that you're changing the way you deal with animals and the respect that you would have for them. I'm not saying that the other generations don't have respect. And actually, that's one thing that frustrates farmers is that, this view abroad, particularly from non-farmers, that, you know, farming is cruel and that farmers are, you know, very cruel to their animals. How do you react to that?
Yeah, like, I don't for a second think that dairy farmers or any farmers are cruel to their animals. You know, you've got a very, very small number of bad apples that might be
and they're
guilty
prosecuted
of that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And as they should be. And I think we as farmers are very eager that those who, you know, mistreat their animals are prosecuted.
But how important is animal welfare on your farm?
Well, it's crucially important to us. And we're really proud of the care we provide for our animals. I think it's not just my generation has changed. There's been a change in public attitudes towards animal welfare over the last number of decades. And what we've basically changed from is trying to provide animals with a life that was free from pain or suffering or discomfort. Now we want to provide them with a life worth living, a life where they get to experience pleasure and, you know, are curious and, you know, living a kind of more enjoyable life.
And is that possible while they're still being milked twice a day?
I think the vast majority of farmers know that they are providing that life for their cows. You know, there are days when obviously nature beats us and it can be tough to do, but once you start talking about this subject with dairy farmers in particular, you know, they'll mention things like, you know, when they leave the cows into a fresh paddock of grass and they can hear the, you know, the sound of the cows eating the grass, and it's just a beautiful sound, and you know the herd is happy and healthy. And it's, you know, another instance is when you leave the cows out to grass for the first time and they gallop around the fields for the sheer joy of it. You know, those are great examples of when you see your cows being happy and healthy.
And how important is that to you, that you understand, if I can put it like this, the personality of your cows?
Yeah, so when you're discussing animal welfare, there's three important aspects. So you've got the biological functioning of the animal, which refers to its health, its nutrition, its environment. Then you've got the affective state of the animal, which is its emotional state and how the animal feels about its own experience. And that's something that maybe, you know, we didn't really consider in the past. You know, hundreds of years ago, people thought of animals just as machines. But there's an increasing amount of evidence now to show that animals actually do live rich emotional lives and that they experience a lot of the same emotions as we do. And, you know, just knowing that those are there, it allows us to manage the animals in a way that, you know, creates positive opportunities.
We live in the social media age where all it takes is one video of animal cruelty, and it could be anywhere in the world or a very intensive operation to spoil it for farmers like yourself who actually do care for your cow's welfare. And you travel the world. Did you see a big divergence in the way animals are treated, we'll say in California, for example, and the way they're treated on Irish farms? And Irish farms still remain relatively, in global terms, very small in terms of the extensification or intensification of farm size.
So I don't want to be talking down any system, because obviously you've got, I'm sure you have excellent farmers in California as well. But one farm I visited in particular, just the huge scale that they were operating at, it makes it very hard to, you know, provide individualized care for an animal. And I suppose we're very fortunate here that our pasture-based system has led us down kind of an extensive route where we keep our animals in groups and herds, and they get to live a very natural sort of life, as opposed to more intensive systems where animals are confined and, you know, mightn't have a lot of space to move around if they're in an individual hutch. And so, yeah, that was upsetting.
What did you see in California?
So one farm I just saw, a calf ranch that had 80,000 calves.
80,000?
80,000, yeah. In small little, you know, calf hutches. And if I'd choose somewhere to be a calf, it wouldn't have been there. It would definitely have been an Irish dairy farm, by contrast.
And can we make as I said, in the current debate we're having now about changing diets, about climate change, about animal welfare, and about how we need to change the system of farming in this country, a lot of people who are, if I can be so blunt as to say, anti-farming or anti-livestock farming, you know, they can't get rid of dairying and beef farming quick enough. It's not as easy as that. What do we do with the land, etc., and so on? And you have to, it can't just happen overnight. But is there a huge marked difference between the sort of farming, this is what I'm trying to get to, and the animal welfare of calves and cows in Ireland compared to what you saw around the rest of the world?
Absolutely.
Or is it all the
same? You know, it's all called milk, but the Irish product really is a totally different product to what's being produced in confinement operations around the world. And now other countries have excellent production systems as well, such as New Zealand and there's parts of the UK and Europe that are also producing milk and meat in a very animal-friendly way. But that's the challenge for us. And, you know, I think, like, there's a tendency maybe for us to just stick our heads in the sand and, you know, feel hard done by that. Everyone's giving out to farmers in the media. But really, like, improving animal welfare also, you know, poses a huge opportunity for farmers, because as we improve the welfare of our animals, their productivity and profitability can also increase. So, you know, it's to see the positives to be got from it and not just to see it as a negative and a constant pressure, you know, on cost.
And do you think the majority of Irish farmers are with you on this? Like, the fact that you've actually done this and put together a summary of recommendations would suggest that we're not at that standard yet fully in this country.
I think we are doing an excellent job in Ireland, but just because we're doing a good job and we're proud of what we do doesn't mean we can't look for the areas where we can do a bit better. Mm. And it's just to try and identify those areas and to go after them and to do better by our animals. I've been really, really pleased by the feedback I'm getting from farmers. You know, I've had guys send me messages asking for, you know, more information on a specific topic and, you know, can I point them towards a supplier for, you know, an ID ankle strap instead of freeze branding and this sort of stuff. So I think farmers, you know, are excited by the opportunity to be proactive on this and not just to, you know, getting beaten up in the media about it.
No, you're very passionate about it. It's from the heart. You do actually believe, you know, that looking after your animals, they'll look after you, as it were, if you want to think about it bluntly as a commercial operation in that regard, as well as, of course, seeing your animals happy and they make you happy as well. That's quite obvious. Colm, can we have a look at some of your report online, Nuffield?
Yeah, you can. If you just Google Nuffield Ireland and search under scholars, you'll find my name and my report and there's a video of my presentation there as well.
Brilliant. People can have a look at that and indeed the other scholars who made their presentations at the annual conference in Dublin last week. Colm, great to chat to you. A rare morning off from the milking for you to come up and chat to us, and well done on your report. It's novel and interesting, and it's in everyone's interest that animals are looked after on farm.